Good evening. You are listening to The Talking Show on K-Chung Radio, Chinatown's only micro-broadcasting radio station for the arts. I am Nicholas Miller, and I'm here in the K-Chung Studios, live with Steve Cato. Hey, Steve.
Yes. Hello. Nice to see you. Glad that we have put all that USC rowing crew business behind us.
Yeah, I think that scandal will be cleanly tucked underneath the giant mess that was the COVID-19 pandemic.
Yeah, exactly. No one's going to follow up on that.
No.
Episode. You know, everyone who is one of our normal extreme listeners, they have all, they were all pretty busy with COVID.
You definitely
know, comings and goings, concerns, thinking about what it means for them, fashion, etc.
Yeah.
They were not sweating the talking show as much. So I think that embarrassing episode is behind us.
I mean, no one even talks about the proper rowing scandal at USC anymore.
No, it's true. And I mean, who can blame us for trying all the COVID vaccines, you know?
No, I mean, it was a touch selfish. You can blame us for that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. All right, yeah, sure. In light of the situation that unfolded in India, for example.
Yeah.
Selfish.
It's a bit selfish. It's
bad. Yeah. Egg on our face. Fair enough. Fair enough. Yeah. That critique is an honest one, but I mean, otherwise, come on. I mean, like, don't you want to try every flavor of Skittle? Come on.
Yeah.
Come on, listener. Come on.
Put all the Starburst in your mouth at once.
Was it with? Correct. Tell me if I'm wrong or if this was some, you know, because I'm still not back to my normal pattern of intense sociality, so I don't remember if it was talking to you or someone else. But Starburst, just speaking of Starburst, they were originally created as fruit M&Ms before they were spun off into their own thing. Was this a conversation we had on air or just between ourselves, or was this something from another social interaction I have had?
I can't even speak. I'm speechless from the shock of this idea. So it certainly wasn't me.
Yeah. So I heard. Okay. So then I'm bringing this to the listeners hot and fresh. Apparently, Starburst were invented by the M&M people.
Oh my God.
And they were invented as a kind of fruit M&M.
Are you saying, Steve, that Starburst were an inside job?
Yes, and they were an inside job both by Big M&M, which if that was not bad enough, they were also an inside job by Big Floor Wax, which is the other main ingredient in Starburst, gosh. Which is the thing that you use, the janitor in the high school uses to buff the tiles. Yeah.
Is nothing sacred in late capitalism, Steve?
I mean, the fact that the major candy for several decades has been made out of the same thing as floor wax is, I think, you know, a testament to the strength of capitalism, if anything, right?
Yeah.
It's like, you think that, like, we need specialization? No, we have, like, specialization in marketing alone. The product is the same.
Right. Add some dye and some packaging.
Yeah. Yeah, we put it in little cubes. Now it's a snack. We, you know, like, Mr. Handy just squirts it through a tube into this thing that he drives around the high school every other day. You know, that's wax.
I always assumed it was a bit more of like a silly putty story where, like, you know, JPL had accidentally invented it. And then there was like a office joke, like who could market this thing, you know, who could find a way to get this, make this sellable.
That's the case with Post-it notes.
Yeah. Right?
That's the origin story of the Post-it note and the silly putty and everything. Right. Yeah.
It doesn't really stick permanently. Oh, who's going to want that?
And then they're like, yeah, no, that's actually what everyone wants. No one wants
their notes.
Write the note forever. Yeah, exactly.
Don't forget the groceries, hun, forever.
Didn't we get cat food? No, that's last week.
Forever.
It's on the fridge forever. That's the story tale of sort of accidental innovation, right? That's the idea of pure research.
Mm-hmm. I was checking in with the wealthiest people on the planet list as I do from time to time.
You're looking for clients, right? You're like,
I'm always just curious to see what is listed as the reason for accumulating wealth, you know. And there are some obvious
things. I mean, we know who the top three are, right? It's like Jeffy, Bill, and Elon, right?
Yeah. And so, you know, they all, in their own evil way, provide essential services, right? But then there's a guy from China.
Elon Musk does not provide any essential services.
Yeah. Where does his money come from then? Just investment?
The stock market. Yeah. Speculation in Tesla stock.
Sure. You know, there's always exceptions. But there's a guy who's always high up there who is like a candy manufacturer in Italy.
Oh, we talked about this guy before, the Ferrero guy.
Yeah, the Ferrero guy. Yeah. Yeah, I think he was in on the Starburst the Starburst scandal.
What football team does he own?
I don't think he owns a football team.
That's the secret to his wealth, huh?
I just remember in the profile I read of him, because you know, I thought like, what, Chocolatier or something is in the top 20.
It is the Ferrero Rocher guy, right?
Right.
What's his name?
I don't remember, but he's accumulated several other companies at this point. It's not just those delightful little chocolate balls. He owns all sorts of things, all sorts of candy manufacturing things.
He's also the Kinder Egg guy.
Like all European candies, Smarties, okay. All of it come through. They flow through his factories.
But he's not Nestle.
He might even be Nestle. I don't know. Jean-Claude Nestle.
Ooh, well, Nestle's a Swiss company, and they like own Lake Michigan now. No, I'm not even joking.
I know, but why is it? Is there a special water there that they need for, say, I don't know, the Big Crunch bar?
No, I think they just market it as water. Like bottled, literally, it's just bottled water. And the American government just sold it to them.
Wow,
that's the insane shit.
Yeah. They own the air rights of the entire country.
Yeah, and someone's just like, seems reasonable. Why don't we just let this shady, unpublicly traded Swiss company have that instead?
Yeah, you put an antenna on your house, and you get a letter from Nestle. Sorry, we own the air rights to your house. Take that down.
Yeah, no, can't have that.
Yeah, sorry, Kaechung, you can't extend your broadcast.
To be fair, Kaechung has been dealing with harassment from Nestle and other big Swiss chocolatier firms for a while now.
Yeah,
that's my understanding.
Well, I'd say that, yeah, I mean, this is where I was going with this, because I feel like the situation between Nestle and Kaechung Radio is approaching what I would call a crisis, which fortunately we've invited a very wonderful guest on tonight who's going to discuss this exact phenomenon of crises from a bit more of a sartorial angle than a after-dinner candy angle. But anywho, it should be an edge of your seat kind of talk. So please, everyone, join together around the radio. Get ready for the sweet talking of Amy De La Haye.
Hello, my name's Amy De La Haye. I'm a fashion curator, a dress historian, and a writer. My current project is an exhibition called Ravishing the Rose in Fashion, which is an exhibition which is going to open at the Museum at the Fashion Institute of Technology early next year, where I'm working with curator Colleen Hill. And the exhibition is going to look at how the rose has inspired the way we look, feel, and fantasize, dating back from the 18th century to the sort of latest gender neutral and Alexander McQueen sort of catwalk trends. The book has come out as scheduled, and I've got an advanced copy by Yale University Press. And also, I'm really, really pleased and honoured because in the book, Nick Knight, let me use his sublimely beautiful roses from my garden images. I work at London College of Fashion. I'm joint director with amazing exhibition maker, Professor Judith Clark, of the University of the Arts Research Centre for Fashion Curation. So I've got PhD, six PhD students, mostly practice-based, looking at completely incredible subjects from how to exhibit gender-neutral fashion in museum contexts when, amongst other things, the mannequins and the documentation has always been very binary gendered. I have time on my hands. I wrote to Charlotte Knight and asked if she might like me to write a series of essays called Fashion in a Time of Crisis. And the idea was prompted by the mass panic buying of food at the outbreak of COVID and all the shortages on the supermarket shelves. And it just started making me really think about all the shortages in both world wars and draw parallels. I'm going to talk about the four subjects that we looked at, which is food shortages, racism, homophobia, and Nazi control of the Paris haute couture industry. The final story I wrote with Bella Gladman, we looked at the impact of the coronavirus on the creative industries. What unites my work is constructing narratives or telling stories about people's lives, artists, designers, makers, wearers, observers, collectors, and using dress as my primary source of evidence. Mostly I work with objects in museum collections and documents in archives. Moving on to fashion in a time of crisis. The first story I looked at was food because, as I said, that was what sort of prompted the whole series. And I've been interested in the Women's Land Army for years and years. I bought this portrait of a land girl from the First World War in 1981 when I was a student studying dress history at Brighton University. And what really struck me was the modernity of this woman's dress, appearance, demeanour. It was at a time when Yoji and Com were just coming out on the catwalks that workwear was becoming fashionable. Today, as in 1914 and 1939, in fact, Britain as an island nation imports well over half of all the food consumed, which makes us in a very, very vulnerable position, especially in times of crisis like war. It wasn't until the point that food supplies had almost run out that a women's land army was formed. Young women, as young as 17, many had never even visited the country, and nor had they worn trousers. Some were sent on a three-week training course, as the image you can see here, and proudly wearing their uniform. They're wearing white smocks, which meant that they worked in the dairies, couples. They were socially isolated, and they frankly were met with quite a lot of hostility. This is a label of a rare pair of breeches from the First World War that I found in the Imperial War Museum, showing the detail of the breeches from 1917. There was a widespread feeling that they'd come from the cities, they were promiscuous. They looked overtly masculine within quite conservative rural communities because they were away from their families, their independence posed a threat. But ultimately, it was their uniformed appearance that helped form a lot of the negative perceptions about them. And this uniform that they were issued with formed part of their daily lives. It reshaped their bodies and identities, and it really did influence broader perceptions of them. And when we look at this rare colour photograph, which was published by the Daily Mail, you can really see quite how different the women did look from the land girl, even though she's not even wearing proper uniform, but on the right in her breeches, compared to the agricultural women workers who were wearing blouses as opposed to a smock and long skirts. So all the time the women are being portrayed partly in a good-humoured way, but also in a slightly fearful way that they were going to be part of this whole new generation of post-war masculine women. They never got the perks that other forces enjoyed, and they didn't get the recognition afterwards. Even up until about 2008, they weren't allowed to march, and the Second World War land girls weren't allowed to march to the cenotaph of the other forces. And as a result, they were often described as Cinderellas of the soil, which was the name of the exhibition I curated. And the next story was about racism and the Zoot Suit riots. And it's important to say from the outset that this isn't an area of my subject expertise. And the real expert on the subject is my friend and colleague, Professor Carol Tulloch, whose most recent book, The Birth of Cool, is completely amazing. Zoot Suits were first seen in the 1930s in Harlem swing clubs and dance halls, and it was a subcultural creation rather than the creation of one particular designer or tailor. And the name Zoot was believed to derive from bebop rhyming slang, with Zoot rhyming with suit. It was a flamboyant style that reveled in conspicuous consumption, and for many young Black and Latino people, it became a very visible assertion of their identity and a refusal to be treated as subservient second-hand class citizens in a society that really was, and still in many extents is, racist. So the Zoot suit comprised a very long single-breasted waisted jacket with broad padded shoulders, wide lapels, diagonal side pockets, and there were lots and lots of buttons going up the wrists. Fabrics were brightly coloured, often patterned. In his autobiography, Malcolm X talks quite a lot about seeing people wearing suits, and at age 15 going to get his own Zoot suit, which he managed to get on a recommendation on credit, and he chose one that he described as sky blue and just felt amazing wearing it. The trousers were cut ultra high, almost up to the armpits, and then they tapered from being very, very wide down to very, very narrow, so that you could move with ease, but you weren't going to trip when you were dancing the Lindy Hop. And then central to the look was a long, chunky watch chain that hung in a loop from the waistband right down below the jacket hem. And it was mostly a male style, but not exclusively. There were women who wore the jacket with tight skirts and high-heeled shoes. It started in the clubs, but it became brought to much wider attention when it was adopted by leading jazz musicians like Dizzy Gillespie, Louis Armstrong, and Cab Calloway. But this extraordinary suit, completely original, was bought in 2016 by LACMA, Los Angeles County Museum, for their amazing exhibition on menswear called Reigning Men. They paid $80,000 for it at auction, and it's possibly the only Zoot suit that's in a museum collection worldwide, and it's brilliant because it has been preserved. Wearing a Zoot suit was always a radical proposition. But with the onset of the Second World War in America, it became an object of absolute conflict. In March 1942, rationing was introduced in America, which basically outlawed wearing a Zoot suit, which was made from huge quantities of fabric, although some backstreet tailors were prepared to do so for a price. During the first week of 1943, in mid and downtown Los Angeles, riots erupted. Young Latin African and other ethnic minority young men, along with a handful of Caucasians, had their precious Zoot suits slashed with knives. They were also clubbed, and they were publicly stripped to their underwear. The aggressors, mobs of off-duty police officers and sailors out on shore leave. Now, this amazing image, which in many respects could be recaptioned Yoshi Yamamoto from the 1990s, shows three young boys, Walker Roberts, 12, Henry Campbell, 14, and Morris Jackson, 13, and they're photographed feeling $1 million, showing off their new Zoot style suits, which are in fact tuxedos that they'd looted from a formal menswear shop during the Harlem riots in 1943. Now, despite or because of the violence, Zoot became an icon of rebellion for decades to come. It informed the style of suits worn by wartime spiffs and teddy boys, these early teddy boys seen here from the 1950s. And it was more diligently, even fanatically, revived in the early 1980s by New Romantics, Blitz Kids, and singers such as Kid Creole and Chris Sullivan, who we can see here, who was the lead singer in the band Blue Rondana Turk. But the vital issue here is, of course, the ongoing racism and violence across the globe against people of colour, not only in the 1940s, but right up until the present day. This year, many ethnic minority peoples are bearing the brunt of the coronavirus crisis. They're occupying frontline jobs. Those in work, for those in work and those out of work, are facing the worst food and other essential shortages. Black Lives Matter was a movement established in the US in 2013. It's now known worldwide following the outrage about the highly publicised and significantly filmed murder of 46-year-old George Floyd on May the 25th, followed by the also filmed shooting of Jacob Blake in front of his four children on August 23rd. The next story also about horrific violence, and also taking place in the Second World War. It explores the Nazi occupation of Paris and the impact it had upon the Parisian haute couture industries during the Second World War. This photograph shows Nazis marching into Paris on the 14th of June 1940. And clearly the mass genocide of the Nazis orchestrated should never be forgotten, although it would seem that humanity has clearly not yet learned from their barbaric atrocities. But in keeping with the fashion theme of this series, the focus of the story was about how Nazi occupation of Paris impacted the haute couture industries, the designers and clients. And the real expert in this field is the French historian Dominique Vaillant, who's written a book called Fashion Under the Occupation. Within days of the occupation, many international designers left Paris. And here we've got the forces queuing up, waiting to buy the Chanel perfume to take home. During the occupation, Chanel lived at the Ritz Hotel, which she'd lived at before the war, but during the war it was requisitioned by senior Nazi officers, and there she lived with her lover, Hans Gunther von Dinklage, a high-ranking Nazi officer. Meanwhile, many thousands of highly skilled Jewish workers and minority groups, including people who now self-identify as LGBTQ, engaged in fashion and its ancillary trades throughout Europe, were to have their businesses shut down or taken over, they were persecuted and they were murdered. Dispensation was made for a few fur workers, as the German forces required their specialist skills to make them apparel for soldiers fighting on the Russian front. These are some fashion images from 1939, just before Nazi occupation. They're both by the most amazing designer called Lucien Lelong, about whom not a lot is known today. Amazing photograph of a model wearing a like neo-romantic gown on the Eiffel Tower, and on the right, an illustration of another corseted neo-romantic gown, illustrated by Christian Berard, who I think is my favourite fashion illustrator. Adolf Hitler became perhaps peculiarly preoccupied with the Parisian haute couture industries. Yet, he denounced Paris fashion and the slender feminine bodies it idealised as decadent and corruptive to what he perceived to be noble and natural, in inverted commas, Aryan women. Instead, he extolled the virtues of German or regional dress, including dirndl skirts, and also women in uniform, significantly both of which were made on home soil, because he was completely anti-imports. Yet, he was completely enamoured by the glamour and the cultural cachet of Parisian haute couture. He thus determined to relocate the industry to Berlin as part of his broader plan to make the German capital the centre of world culture. Lucien Lelong, whose clothes I just showed you, in his capacity as president of the trade organisation, the Chambre Syndicale de la Couture Parisienne, was summoned to Paris, to Berlin, to discuss the logistics of this. Hitler is completely convinced he wants to move the whole industry lock, stock and barrel. And he's a complete fantasist. So after much persuasion and diplomacy, Lelong managed to persuade him that it simply wasn't possible, that Paris fashion could only survive in Paris and Paris, that it was part of a broader culture, not least all the vital ancillary trades which supported it, the flower makers. And so after much persuasion, Hitler agreed that the industry could remain in Paris, but it would actually be absolutely controlled by the Nazis. Henceforth, all exports upon which the industry depended so vitally stopped. From that moment on, communication with the outside world was severed. And it's at this point, interestingly, as an aside, that cut off from Paris, that actually New York and London start really asserting their own fashion identities. So this slide shows an image. The colour image, the illustration, is daywear by the couturier Jacques Fatt. And on the right is a photograph of a model wearing Balenciaga. During the war, about 85 houses remained open. But henceforth, their new clientele comprised the wives and lovers of Nazi officers, other collaborators, and also wartime profiteers. And they, along with the most wealthy French women who were prepared to socialise with the Nazis, had to apply for special dispensation. They were given vouchers, which meant they were allowed to place orders for Parisian haute couture. Now, the Nazis allowed the couture industry to continue, but they said that the amount of fabrics used had to be reduced by half, by 50%. So the couturiers, this is why the shorts are, there's a lot of fullness in the skirts. They concentrated fabrics in areas, but other areas are tight fitted. And there was a lot of sort of upswept, very elaborate hats, bishop or batwing sleeves. Peplums on jackets and dresses were popular, with very, very tight waists. This tiny minority are wearing haute couture. Most of the French nation is suffering unbelievably. Germans put in place a coupon system where clothes were rationed, but most people couldn't even afford to buy new clothes anyway. So as ever, the second-hand market flourished and old clothing was repurposed. There was lots and lots of patchwork clothing, and at their best, some of these garments, you know, we could liken them to abstract paintings. And I was also quite interested to look at these because at the time of writing, it was when the new collections were being shown, not on the catwalk. And I'd noticed there was lots of patchwork. And these skirts and dresses were known as La Robe Mille Morceaux and the Dress of a Million Pieces. You know, hand-stitched by women from old clothes, which were probably redolent with meaning that had belonged to family members, to create vital garments for themselves and others. And the couturiers came under a lot of criticism. In many respects, they were considered to collaborate with the regime. But collaboration is a contentious and complex subject. Certainly some designers like Jacques Fatt were seen photographed at Nazi receptions with his model wife and would seem to have integrated quite willingly with the Nazi regime. Other designers claimed that they created models that deliberately made their clients look ridiculous. Retrospectively, historians have variously interpreted these wartime activities as collaboration or as an absolutely necessary survival strategy, not least one that ensured the livelihoods of some 12,000 workers. The final story I'm going to discuss today is the devastating global impact that AIDS had around the world, but with the focus of this series again, looking at the broader issues, but looking at them very much through the lens of dress. Now, of all the stories, this was the one that I felt most profoundly, not least because it was a period that I lived through. So for many of us in our 50s and older, the COVID-19 pandemic, a global and indiscriminate virus about which very little is known and for which there's currently no cure. It recalls painful memories of the 1980s and 90s when the AIDS pandemic reached its peak. But unlike COVID, this disease was originally and entirely inaccurately thought to exclusively target one already marginalised section of society, gay men. And as such, within a culture of homophobia, finding a cure was not prioritised. Compelling gay men to protest and campaign for their own equality, for broader visibility, and ultimately that investment be made in the disease and vital medicine and vaccines be found to cure it. By 1982, at the point when the spread of the disease had become rampant and the establishment could no longer ignore it, it was named GRID, which was an acronym for gay-related immune deficiency. And the debilitating symptoms, including severe weight loss and Kaposi sarcoma, which was the most awful skin cancer, were all the more shocking because they ravaged the lives of the bodies of the young and fit, often the super fit. And in the prevailing climate of fear and bigotry, homophobia and gay bashing became more and more rife. And it wasn't helped by the popular media that fanned the flames by reporting that AIDS, as it later became called, that it could be contracted by any contact with anyone who had the virus, who were HIV positive, or even items they touched. So they've got ridiculous stories about, you know, if you touch something, someone that had HIV touched, you were going to get the virus. So it created a complete panic. As with COVID, New York became an epicenter for AIDS, and the effects upon the designers, stylists, photographers, graphic artists, hairdressers, journalists, display artists, showroom and retail workers, and many other creatives that comprise the city's second largest industry and its most highly visible industry significantly, were calamitous. Dr. Valerie Steele, who's the amazing director at the Museum at the Fashion Institute of Technology, where I'm working on the Roses exhibition, has curated scores of exhibitions, including the seminar, A Queer History, From the Closet to the Catwalk, which she curated in 2013. And I talked to her about writing this piece, and she told me, and I quote, AIDS had a devastating impact on the fashion world of New York, as it did on the arts in general. Many of the most talented designers died, from Halston to Willie Smith. The atmosphere of fear brought out loathsome bigotry, as male designers were fired if they couldn't prove that they didn't have AIDS. But a committed segment of the fashion industry joined forces with AIDS activists to raise money to help people who were sick and to pressure the government into taking action. Susan Bartsch, the Swiss Miss of Club Life, created the Love Ball, which raised money and morale at a really horrible time. In 1987, the newly launched protest group ACT UP used silence equals death, shown alongside an inverted print triangle as their slogan. The history and meaning behind this pink triangle evidences humanity is absolute most barbaric. When Hitler came to power in Germany in 1933, he invoked the criminalization of homosexuality, which, whilst it dated back to 1871, had barely been invoked. And he rounded up some 100,000 men who were perceived to be gay over the ensuing 12 years. It's shocking that we don't know the numbers, but between 5 and 15,000 of these men were sent to the concentration camps as part of his mad and evil quest to purify the German nation. Once there, they were made to wear a prominent pink triangle cloth on their uniforms, and other marginalized groups were classified by different colored triangles. And what were described as gypsies wore brown, political prisoners red, immigrants blue, and what were described as asocial people, which included lesbians and prostitutes, black. Alongside so many other horrors and the mass murder, men wearing the pink triangle were sterilized, they were subject to medical experiments, bullied and tortured. So in the 1980s, the gay community subverted and inverted this pink triangle to create a pyramid. And the pyramid's a shape long associated with action, change, and healing. The image here is a t-shirt with a design by the amazing artist Keith Haring, who sadly also died of AIDS, campaigning for AIDS awareness. And as we can see, he's written Silence Equals Death and the Pink Pyramid. By 1990, a feature in New York Times quoted Virginia Estrada. She was sister of the New York designer Angel Estrada. Again, an amazing designer about whom little is known. She said, health has become the most important thing in fashion, more important than the cut of the clothes. And shockingly, she stated that it was when her brother died that the outlook for the company became better. Angel died on the 7th of September, 1989. He was 31 years old, and along with other fashion talents, including Willie Smith, who died on the 17th of April, 1987, and Patrick Kelly, who died on the 1st of January, 1990, they were amongst the designers and people working in the industry who certainly deserve greater recognition within fashion history. Marc Jacobs famously went on to revive the fortunes of Perry Ellis, who died on the 20th of October, 1986. And whereas Perry Ellis insisted that his illness be kept secret because he was frightened about the impact it would have on his business after his death, Halston, who died 4 years later, on 26th of March 1990, arranged to have his beloved Rolls Royce auctioned with all the proceeds going to AIDS research. Within this climate, for the first time ever, financiers considered women designers to be infinitely more investable than male talent. And a lot of male talent was pushed at this time. So it's not a coincidence that the 1990s is often described as the decade of the woman designer. Part of our preparation for death is the sorting out of our personal possessions. We give them away, we safeguard them, or we destroy them. And I would argue that clothing, more than any other media, bears evidence of lives lived. Worn clothing bears evidence of lives lived. It bears testimony to the stains and wears of everyday life. It absorbs our personal sense. It alters according to our body shape, like knitwear stretches or whatever. And as a result, it's often the hardest thing to know what to do with when someone we love dies. And that's partly why the reason that people give their clothes to museums, because if they're amazing designs, they want the design to be preserved. But quite often it's because they want to ensure that the memory and the meaning of those garments is ensured for future eyes. As a dress curator working at the V&A in the 1990s, and subsequently, I'm accustomed to people of all ages coming and donating their own clothes or bequests from people they've loved. But what was really, really shocking in the 1990s was that the demographic shifted completely. A lot of the people coming to give clothes were young men in preparation for their own death, or from people they'd loved or administrators to whom they'd asked to bequeath clothes. You know, it was completely emotionally devastating. Amongst the most memorable donations was a collection of clothes. I was asked if I'd go and look, and I asked the person if they could bring them in, and he said, no, there's just too many. So I went to a flat and was presented with bags and bags and bags of clothes worn by a young man called Rupert Michael Dolan, who was an absolute Vivienne Westwood fanatic. He bought clothes he could wear, from like football leotards that he wore to gay clubs, to sort of Norfolk suits. And he also bought things that he just fell in love with and didn't wear as a collector. He just had to own them. Another group of clothes was a bequest from amazing designers who worked sort of in the spirit of Fortuny, amazing painted and pleated silks. Ian and Marcel again, who both died of AIDS. And I did a display of their clothes and opened, it was a small exhibition, opened it on the 1st of December, World AIDS Day, and persuaded the museum director to let me put a big red ribbon in the museum, in the case. Now, these things don't sound that radical now, but if you backtrack 20, 25 years, it was shocking, and even doing that sort of thing in a museum was, it was daring, and it was, to be honest, it was unprecedented. So since the 1980s, over 30 million people worldwide have died of AIDS. It wasn't until 1996, 1 year after my absolute best friend in the world died, that antiretroviral drugs were developed and ensured people would have longer life expectancy. However, the perceived stigma that continues to be associated with the disease lingers, and it forms a huge barrier to many individuals, families and communities living around the world, often in societies that are not tolerant, battling with AIDS. Today, plans are afoot to create museum collections to gather oral testimonies and other forms of legacy to mark the current COVID crisis. As with the AIDS crisis, it's already all too apparent that ultimately it's inequality of power, status and wealth that is the major determinant of who survives and who does not.
Wow.
Amy.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah, that was pretty gripping.
I think so.
Yeah. No, I was I've only read Amy in some fashion catalogs, but never heard her talk, and I gotta say, quite a good talker at that.
Yeah, and great. What a good selection of periods. You know, it's usually on the talking show we get people who are monomaniacal. You know, we get freaks.
Yeah, like that blender guy.
Yeah, one thing. I talk about one thing over sort of one, either its whole life or just in one narrow section of it of time. And it's nice to have someone be like, all right, let's just do some episodes. You know, let's jump around.
Yeah. Let's
jump up. Jump up and get down.
I'm afraid that song is out of fashion, Steve.
What you're not aware of is how relevant that song became yesterday.
I see. I know Steve and I were...
On TikTok, House of Pain is huge.
Yeah. Well, it must be dizzying to be a fashion historian, because I think I'm not sure how Amy does it in her greater career, but when you use the capital F fashion, you're kind of only referring to like 19th century on. I think before that, they just call it costume or something.
Okay.
So there's that. But then within that, the like the cycles are at a breakneck pace.
Quarterly, basically, right?
Yeah. Well, I think even that's gone out the window in the last 5 or 10 years after the introduction of resort. Which is a moment of the fashion year that I've never partaken in. Like I've never gone like, oh, I need to get some stuff for the resort season.
It must be nice.
Yeah.
You know, like the problems fashion solves, it must be nice to have those problems.
Yeah, like what am I going to wear to Can?
Yeah. What are my resort? I'm going to the resort. What shall I wear?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was recently in Palm Springs, which one could argue is an entire community that is a resort.
Yeah, that resort is the yearly. They don't get to fall winter there.
They really do not get fall winter. But I was like, what is the fashion? The fashion just seems to be sort of like nervous elder gay with like a V-neck sweater.
Yeah, like Jean-Paul Gaultier, Versace, that stuff.
Well, but not the actual Gaultier looks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I feel like that's maybe like maybe a Gaultier poster.
Have you ever been to Mitchell's?
No, what's Mitchell's?
Mitchell's is like a high-end used clothing store on the main drag there in Palm Springs, run by a man. Not really. I don't think his name is Mitchell, but yeah, it's an object study in that fashion. Like, you know,
no way. So they have like real Gaultier, like sort of like male bustiers and stuff like that in there.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And like, you know, the like very short cotton shorts, like you just kind of,
yes.
I always kind of assumed that that was just like, I didn't know that there was like a proper high end version of those, but I can't remember the designer's name. But of course, there's like a French guy or a Swiss guy or something who's like specializes in like the pastel cream colored really short cotton shorts, and they're like they're like $300 a piece or something. So you discover all sorts of wonderfully niche resort clothes over there at Mitchell's.
I'll have to check that out next time I'm out there. Yeah. I feel like I'm going to start going to Palm Springs more, I got to say. I feel like, you know, it's obscene that there is a place with that much lawn in the middle of the Mojave Desert. And so therefore it's like screaming to me, you know, it's like calling my name. I'm like, oh, I've got to go see this lawn.
Do you think
this desert lawn?
You know, I read an article a number of years ago that for the most part, our generation is not playing golf. You know, because
I think that's probably true. I don't have many friends who are playing golf. Do you?
I mean, we're probably in the wrong town for it. Like, if we lived in like, you know, somewhere in like Michigan or something, maybe. But you know, like I feel like we both have friends who have like done well financially in their fields, and I think in like, historically in the US, like then you play golf, right? That's where like you stash the money or something, is in golf clubs, and that's where business deals are done, supposedly, like in the the 80s movies and stuff.
Club, and then that's how you would get access to the old man's money.
Yeah, and it, you know, it has all sorts of class implications and racial implications as well, but I don't really see that going on anymore.
Yeah, we've effectively weaponized like the old man, like the idea, right, was that you would play golf with your manager, who would be a little older than you, and they would maybe introduce you to the guy in charge, who's older still.
Yeah.
Right? And so this intergenerational transfer of masculine power. But now the situation is such that like either the people who are truly in charge do not care, or it's literally their children. And you are literally trying to like play golf with someone who's like 10 years younger than you. And the only way you can lure them into financial congress with you, flawed as you are, is through like their own fear of irrelevance. Like, you have to be like, no, you need me because only through me will you achieve virality. Right?
Yeah.
Like, that's the bargain being made.
On the golf course.
Well, it's not being made on the golf course anymore. You just literally are like, I have a bunch of teens in a content house right now who are so relevant.
Yeah.
You have to talk to me.
Right.
It's like every...
Yeah, it's like the relation is like, I will no longer play golf with my grandfather, but I'll teach him how his TiVo works.
Well, it's like, you will no longer play golf with your grandfather, but your grandfather will be Keanu Reeves, and you are like, your grandfather's Keanu Reeves, and you are Dennis Hopper in Speed, and you have an entire bus full of people hostage. That's basically it. And the bus full of people that are hostage are your TikTok content house. That's my understanding of the situation. It's like, so as a contractor, you're Dennis Hopper, basically, in Speed. That's my understanding of the situation.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head, Steve. But all this to say that I think that there'll be quite a bit of change in the coming years to this lawn that you speak of in Palm Springs. Because there won't be much need for that lawn without the game of golf.
And so you feel like it will I feel like golf's still got several decades left.
You think so? Who knows? I think it's an enormously expensive thing to upkeep, I imagine.
True, and especially in that climactic zone.
Yeah, that and Antarctica are about the worst places you can have golf courses.
For real.
Yeah, but who knows? There could be a resurgence, you know, like craft cocktails came back during our lifetime. That was a mainstay of Palm Springs culture.
Yeah, tell me about it. I'm like five in right now. I'm barely holding on.
Yeah. But yeah, so maybe when all the golf courses tank, we'll all move out there and rent the enormously affordable, case study houses that everyone has fled from to the middle of the country where golf still exists.
Where golf can be practiced affordably.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, what do you think we'll do with that land? Because, it's a very special kind of landscape that's created for golf as well.
It's true. Rolling hills. Sand traps. Maybe they turn it into public parks. That would be a coup.
And you can just perambulate out there?
I mean, it's not the best environment to perambulate in.
Right? That's why they have carts.
Yeah, it's more of a like a scuttle from shade to shade kind of place. Yeah, I don't know.
Maybe they'll just free it from golf and you can just dune buggy around the whole thing. It'll just be like a public dune buggy course afterwards.
Yeah.
They'll give up in the grass.
I guess, I this whole theory of mine, I'm making a crucial error in thinking that even though the desire or need dissipates, that the thing will go away. Maybe that won't happen in this case.
Like, the institution of golf will be too stubborn, even though no one's golfing.
Yeah, no one will be golfing at all. Like, no one has golfed in 15 years, but they'll still just be watering the shit out of those patches of grass.
I feel like that is really the true story of humanity.
Yeah, it was NFTs and golf just ruined the whole planet.
Oh, that's delightful. Yeah, it'll just be like golf will just get put in the blockchain.
Yeah.
And then it will have to exist forever. Oh boy, it'll be on the ledger. No one can disrupt the golf. Oh, what if the proof of work is just driving a golf course cart around on the golf course? Like some sort of golf-based blockchain credit derivative.
I did think about Palm Springs during Amy's talk, especially the moment where she was talking about donations. and how difficult people find it. I, you know, I, and I haven't, fortunately, have not had to do this for a loved one yet, but of figuring out what to do with their clothes.
Yeah.
And I did have this idea one time while visiting my grandparents in Palm Springs. And I went to a thrift store there, and it was obviously just stocked full of Lacoste shirts.
Nice.
And and like, yeah, cardigans and whatnot, short shorts. Nothing that really struck my fancy, but yeah.
But that is exactly how I dress.
True. Well, you should check out the, I mean, now there's a whole cottage industry around it, right? There's people just waiting for the donations to then sell them on Grailed or something like that.
Yeah. The good stuff.
Yeah. So no more great finds. Thanks again, internet.
Yeah, first Discogs, then pants on Grailed.
There's really just nothing sacred.
Well, I still worship the sun as an organism so that it can eventually discharge a large solar flare and create an EMP. That's my only hope. I'm basically just dreaming that, you know, like, all right, I talk about this a lot, but I think about it a lot. The James Franco Planet of the Apes reboot, where there's a huge, there's a plague that decimates humanity, and in the sort of closing credits, post-credits sequence, someone just uses a computer as a doorstop to keep a door open.
Okay.
Because, you know, you can't use computers anymore because the internet failed. So there's no reason to have a computer. There's just, you know, you just use them as doorstops. And we as humans have to learn to get along with the monkeys. And this is the plot setting us up for the second Planet of the Apes reboot sequel, which it's a diminishing return situation. It doesn't, they unfortunately cannot, you know, unfortunately that reboot series peaked with a James Franco vehicle, but be that as it is, I still love that conclusion. You know, like, I spend a lot of time thinking about programming computers, and I can't wait for them to just not exist anymore.
Yeah.
Just want them to go away. Go away. You guys, go away. Bye bye. Go away. That's what I want. So,
but then we would have to stop the doors with piles of Lacoste polo shirts.
Once the computers have gone away. You
mean? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, this is what I mean. Like, we'll save space for the Lacoste shirts by using computers to stop up the doors.
Yeah, life really does find a way.
The other motto of the talking show. We should remake our website. You know, it's time for a redesign, I think. So, listeners, look forward in 2022 on New Year's. We'll relaunch the website, and we will include our what has become truly our subtitle for the whole show after these 12 years on the air. The talking show, Life Finds a Way.
Oh, goodness. Well, to keep on living, you guys should get some rest out there, because it's late. And here we are, the talking show, signing off. Good morning, Chinatown.
Good evening. Blam.